Police are investigating an apparent murder-suicide in Kalispell. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce updates us on the status of a boy behind the Helena bomb threats. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry looks at the importance of weather buoys on Flathead Lake. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a Montana Coal Board member about the impacts of transporting coal by rail. Police in Kalispell are investigating the deaths of two people in an apparent murder-suicide. Officers say a man called 911 at 12:41 a.m. today and reported his father had just shot his mother and was going to commit suicide. Responding officers found two people on the floor in a bedroom. Police say both died from gunshot wounds. The case is still being investigated and the names of the victims have not been released. And in other news from around the state, a state psychiatrist says a Colorado man is competent to stand trial in the murder of an Eastern Montana teacher despite his low scores on mental fitness tests. Today's testimony from psychiatrist Virginia Hill contrasted sharply with the defense portrayal of 24-year-old Michael Keith Spell as not fit for trial because he is mentally disabled and unable to understand the case against him. Hill suggested Spell's low test scores belie his mental competency. She described him as playing video games, doing his own laundry, and manipulating other patients during his two-month stay at Montana State Hospital in Warm Springs. Spell is charged with murdering Sydney High School teacher Sherry Arnold in 2012 and could face the death penalty if convicted. A co-defendant implicated by Spell as Arnold's killer has pleaded guilty under a deal with prosecutors. A California boy charged in a series of bomb threats in Helena last week may face years in a Montana youth detention facility if convicted. Court documents say 14-year-old Cole Woodruff admitted to calling in three bomb threats from an app on his iPod. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says Woodruff also implicated a 16-year-old Helena High School student in the calls.
Lewis and Clark County Attorney Leo Gallagher says 14-year-old Cole Woodruff is being accused of committing three acts of felony intimidation, one for each of the three bomb threats which temporarily evacuated Helena schools last week. But Gallagher says Woodruff is being charged with being a delinquent youth.
This sort of a crime, given the age of the youth, is something that you cannot file as an adult. The theory of the juvenile justice system, a juvenile cannot commit a crime. He or she can only commit a delinquent act.
All three of last week's threats came into law enforcement dispatchers from the same Montana number. The first said there was a bomb in the Capitol High School gym. The second call threatened elementary schools. The third call threatened all Helena schools. When authorities called the number back, it was routed to an internet-based telephone service called Magic Jack. Law enforcement used that service to track down Woodruff in Dublin, California, who admitted to making the calls from a Magic Jack app on his iPod. Gallagher says Woodruff could be extradited to Montana for the offense.
Maximum that could happen to a youth who is adjudicated a juvenile delinquent is placement at the Pine Hills School for a male until the age of 18.
Gallagher says Woodruff will likely appear before a California youth court judge this week to be advised of his rights. Woodruff will then be able to decide whether or not he wants to fight extradition. The 14-year-old boy says in court documents that he worked on the idea for the bomb threats with a 16-year-old Helena High student he had met online while playing Xbox. Gallagher says this Helena High student will likely be charged with accountability in the threats. I'm Dan Boyce reporting in Helena.
The Missoula City and County Health Department plans to celebrate receiving national accreditation from the Public Health Accreditation Board, something only 31 out of over 3,000 health departments around the country have achieved. Accreditation is relatively new. It's only been offered since 2011, but the process to receive it is rigorous and thorough, according to Health Department Director Ellen Leahy.
It's a good way to standardize. It's a good way to see if your local health department or your state health department is actually meeting the standards that now exist.
Leahy says the accreditation screening included a site visit in January by a team that came away impressed with Missoula's health department.
And they were really struck by the community engagement and support. And they actually said, you know, is the health department responsible for that or the community? And the health department said, well, the community is, and the community folks said, well, it's kind of both. That's kind of the spirit in Missoula. So they were very impressed by that. And that's where I really want to point out that a health department doesn't improve public health by itself, and it certainly won't get it through accreditation without that kind of community support.
Leahy says the reviewers were also impressed with the health department's various boards and with its commitment to keep improving. Accreditation has to be renewed every 5 years. The department plans to celebrate the recognition by hanging the accreditation seal on the front of the health department building at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Two large yellow buoys with Flathead Lake Biological Station stenciled on the side now sit on the shore beside the lake they've been collecting data on since 2011. These weather buoys were also measuring water quality and temperature, among other things. Katrin Fry reports they're out for routine maintenance, but when they can go back depends largely on funding.
The Flathead Lake Biological Station sits tucked into the protected shelter of Yellow Bay along the east shore of the lake. On the rocky beach, two buoys sit off kilter. They loom up above research scientist Tom Bansack.
The main portion of the buoy is a large yellow foam flotation disc, I would call it. And then mounted to the top of that is a metallic support structure on which we had solar panels mounted, and then a tower on which our weather station equipment was mounted as well.
Below the buoys, an underwater profiler traveled up and down the cable, collecting water quality information, including temperature, the amount of algae in the water, and dissolved oxygen. The buoys were taken in so the instruments could be recalibrated and the batteries replaced after first going into the lake in August of 2011. One went in toward the middle of the lake, offshore from Yellow Bay. The other, farther north, mid-lake, off the shore of Woods Bay. Dr. Bonnie Ellis of the Biological Station says the buoys were designed by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. She says this deployment into Flathead Lake was experimental.
The previous deployments in the Arctic, those were just suspended under the ice, and they didn't have any sort of surface meteorological station. So they just had, they drill a hole in the ice, place the buoy through there with or on top of the ice and the profiler through the ice, and then it was just suspended. The difficulty here was this was anchored to the bottom of the lake.
There were some difficulties getting the buoy nearest Yellow Bay out of the water. The cable tethering the Yellow Bay buoy in place had broken, and hundreds of yards of rope and equipment piled up on the bottom of the lake. Retrieving the gear took a makeshift grappling hook, attached to about 200 feet of chain, dragged along the bottom of the lake.
And marked the spot in the water where we knew it was, using a sonar, and then kept making circles around it until we finally were able to snag the big mass, mangled mass.
A National Science Foundation grant funded the initial project. Bansack says the buoys are part of a larger weather station effort. The biological station has monitoring sites around the lake, and teams go out by boat periodically to collect data, but the buoys provided a steady stream of weather and water quality measurements.
So I would say that the most interesting thing is how variable it is around the lake. It can be raining in Yellow Bay and sunny over on Rollins, and the winds can be coming from completely different directions. And having that wind data from the water surface proved invaluable. That's probably the lesson I learned the most, was the wind and weather onshore adjacent to the lake is different than a station that's out on the water.
Ellis says the information gathered goes into their water quality model to help better predict how the lake will react to different variables.
So we will be able to ask questions of the model, like how increasing temperatures affect algal pigments in Flathead Lake. Will they cause algal pigments to increase or decrease? And by using data from the profiler, we can determine how accurate this model is.
Bansack says they would regularly scuba dive down into the lake to clean and maintain the profilers. During this, they found the lake's underwater currents to be remarkably strong.
We would be literally blown by the underwater currents, and you hold onto the cable that you're making your way down, and your feet would be hanging up like a flag, basically, in these really strong underwater currents. And you'd do both buoys in one day, and again, at one buoy, your feet are blowing towards the south, and at the other buoy, your feet are blowing towards the north. So again, there's just, it's very complex and heterogeneous out there in the lake.
Ellis says it's expensive to get the buoys back in the water. To get a feel for some of the costs involved, she says calibrating the underwater sensors costs about $16,000. Calibration of the surface sensors, about $9,000, and more than $10,000 for the satellite link-up.
Everyone wants the buoys to go back in the lake, including us, especially us, but we're going to have to look closely at those costs.
BANSAC says they've had a lot of positive response from the public, especially anglers and boaters looking to find out the wave and weather conditions on the lake, which can vary quite a bit across the Flathead. He says they hope to redeploy this summer. Katrin Fryatt reporting from the Flathead.
Now for a brief correction. Last night in a story about the state's solar energy industry, we incorrectly identified Kyla Mackey as working with the Montana Environmental Law Center. Ms. Mackey actually works with the Montana Environmental Information Center. We regret the error. Coal export-related rail traffic in Montana is rising and not expected to subside anytime soon. Pacific Northwest-bound train traffic can have impacts on communities, leaving some wondering why more can't be done to mitigate those inconveniences. In tonight's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Montana Coal Board member Tom Tao talks about the options available to Montana communities. The Billings attorney is well-versed on the issue as he created the Montana Coal Tax, Montana Coal Tax Trust Fund, and Coal Impact Fund some 3 decades ago.
Because I was very concerned at the time that we were launching into a new huge development of a natural resource in the Treasure State, and I didn't think that we had the tax situation set up properly, so I was concerned that we did that before we really got deeply involved. Other people were working on the environmental issues regarding coal development, some of the issues regarding eminent domain and some of the other questions that involved coal. I worked on the tax.
Pretty prescient thinking.
Well, I was concerned that Montana is the treasure state, that we had valuable resources, which is why they call us the treasure state, the richest hill on earth, obviously the gold and silver, but more importantly the copper that came out of Butte. And it concerns me because after all of that is virtually gone, what do we have to show for it? Very little. We have very little saved for future generations other than a great big hole in the ground that is the largest Superfund site in the country. It seemed to me like we needed a better handle on our affairs than that, and I think people agreed with me, and that's why we passed a 30% coal tax and set aside one half of that for the trust in the Constitutional Coal Tax Trust, and we now can look our future generations in the eye and say we didn't squander your natural resources.
In the long run, are you satisfied with the final product that came out of all that work?
Well, yes, as soon as I lost the election, they rolled it back to 15% instead of 30%. I think that was a mistake, and someday it should be rectified, but I probably won't in the near future. The other thing, of course, is now that we have a huge push for oil, we have the same kind of issues, and we ought to do the same thing. And I'm very concerned that that hasn't been addressed at this point.
Do you see any inroads, anybody talking about doing just that?
Well, yes, we had. Tom Jacobson, a representative from Great Falls, introduced a bill that would be very similar to the trust fund that we set up for coal. He would have set it up for oil, and it maybe wasn't quite as much the same amount, but it was pretty good anyway. I came up and testified for it, but it didn't pass. And maybe another session, there might be some more interest in that. At the same time, we addressed coal impacts in our coal tax. That was a very major portion of the coal tax question, is to make sure that the communities who suffered impacts, particularly those where there's a delay in the amount of revenue that they collect simply because the property tax isn't levied right away and it takes a while, so they may have to have a school that takes care of a lot more kids, and it may be 2 or 3 years before they actually get the full benefit of the mill levy that would then be levied against some of the extra property that would result from the coal development. So there's a delay, and there are some entities, governmental entities, that don't get any benefit at all or very little benefit from the development of coal. That took place again up in the Bakken, up on eastern Montana near Sydney, where the local governments tended to get some money because of the oil revenue, but the cities and towns got almost nothing. And yet the cities and towns suffered a great deal of the impact. Those impacts were all taken care of in coal with the coal board and the system that we set up. So a percentage of the coal tax pie, as we call it, that's the portion that doesn't go into the trust, went into an impact fund. And that impact fund was available for all the governments to apply for impacts.
Yeah, when we talk about these impacts, typically they range from what to what?
Very often it's roads. Sometimes it's school buildings. Sometimes it's other things that are less obvious, like extra need for law enforcement employees, extra need for health matters, things that are impacted because of, in the case of coal, the coal development. It's not only the increase in population as a result of the initial coal development, but also the decrease that comes when the coal development grinds down and phases out. So there's both the increase in population and the decrease in population caused by coal development that can be addressed by the coal board in their grants.
And not to mention impacts as mundane as long trains going through crossings in some communities as well. It's something of an inconvenience, yeah?
That would definitely be an impact if, in fact, the number of coal trains was so great that it requires attention to the rail crossings. That obviously is an impact. The coal companies are hesitant to put in funds. The railroad is hesitant to put in funds. The highway department is hesitant to put in funds. Cities are hesitant to put in funds because of the huge cost of doing something like that. And so they all just kind of say no. Well, I think in this case, the coal board is uniquely set up to handle that because they can simply say to someone, look, you go get all these other parties to participate to some extent, and then we'll give you a grant. So we don't have enough money. At this point, the appropriations from the 2.9% of the coal tax pie is not sufficient to justify a very large grant, but it will allow for some. And we can say, you get everybody else on board, and then we will give you some grant money to finish the project.
How do you respond to critics, people like State Senator Essman, who say the board favors requests from smaller communities?
Well, I've heard that criticism before I became a member of the board. I think that might have been one of the reasons they appointed me from Billings to the board. I doubt if that's going to be a concern. I haven't seen it while I've been on the board. But I'll have to admit we haven't had any requests from larger cities. And yes, the coal board primarily grants funds to the traditional coal areas like Coal Strip, the Rosebud County, the Bighorn County, and now Roundup. So, because those are the areas where most of the coal is mined in Montana.
Let's say that a larger community, a Billings or a Helena, really makes a convincing and unified argument and presentation. They say these trains are really slowing us down in our communities. What's it cost to create just a simple no-frills, I don't know what the solution would be, an overpass or an underpass? That's got to be, I would assume, very expensive, and it's going to take more than just a unified, solid argument, yeah?
That's more than any one of the various sources of revenue can handle. Yes, I think that's correct. I don't know for sure. I'm not familiar myself, but I've heard the numbers bandied around that it might cost up to $20 million to put in an underpass or an overpass. Overpasses may not be quite so expensive. Moving the tracks out of the center of Billings into another location, for instance, would probably be a better solution. My guess is that would cost even more. We, the coal board, gets something like $3 million a year, $3.2 million a year from the coal natural resource account. That's not enough to take care of that kind of an expenditure. And, you know, it's just not possible. But we could make a seed grant, a grant to help do the preliminary study of what kind of a structure should be built or what should be done. And then we could give a grant that would be conditioned on their getting the railroad to contribute, the coal companies to contribute, the city to contribute, the Department of Transportation and the state of Montana to contribute and get a little bit from everybody, so that it could be possible. That should be doable.
Mm. So, in other words, come to the board with your ducks in a row.
That's right.
Last question. How well prepared is Montana to deal with this ongoing and the future oil and gas boom?
I think we've set that up very nicely for the coal. And I think the coal board does its job very well. And it's on a grant basis. Independent people who have no axe to grind, who are not necessarily a part of any of the applicants, so that they can make an independent decision on who has the most compelling case for an impact. Yes, I think that's set up very nicely. Oil, I think, is very deficient. We do not have the mechanism set up at this time. I think we need something like the same thing we have for the coal board for oil, whether it's could be joined in with the coal board and make it the coal and oil board like I proposed, or whether it needs to be a separate entity, or even if it's done by the Department of Commerce, that would probably work as well. But something I think needs to be set up.
I've been speaking with Billings attorney and Montana Coal Board member Tom Tao. Thank you so much for your time today.
Okay, you bet.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and lows in the upper 20s to mid-30s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow and highs in the 40s. For central Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain and snow and lows 20 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of light freezing rain in the morning and rain and snow in the afternoon with highs 35 to 45 degrees. For southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies and a slight chance of rain and snow and lows 25 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of light freezing rain in the morning and rain and snow through the day. Highs 40 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Dan Gallagher.
This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint. After two consecutive rather serious commentaries, I thought it might be good to lighten the focus a bit. So I decided to do this one about veteran songs. The problem is, most veteran music, save for the more martial red, white, and blue anthems, are pretty strong in pathos and lamentation for the lives lost. They tend to make it graphically clear that there has to be an alternative to sending our loved ones, our sons and daughters and brothers and fathers, off to war. Now, I'm not talking about those songs whose central theme is anti-war, Pete Seeger's Where Have All the Flowers Gone being a prime example. And mind you, I love Seeger's Flowers song, but it and most similar ballads are more about the war itself than about the veterans who fought it. On the flip side, I have little tolerance or taste for the super patriotic songs that were an obnoxious byproduct of the big war of the 1940s. For example, one performance of Irving Berlin and Kate Smith's God Bless America per year more than satisfies my need to hear the flag being waved so boldly in song. Still, there are a few such songs that I appreciate and enjoy. Ones that actually recognize the soldier's service and sacrifice. Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA, Billy Ray Cyrus's Some Gave All, and Dirk Bentley's Home, numbered among my favorites. Now, what brought this musical interlude to my mind as a commentary topic was, well, was St. Patrick's Day. You see, I'm of Irish extraction. My dad grew up in Donegal, Ireland, where he was a Sinn Féin rebel, joined in the guerrilla war against British imperialism. I grew up hearing the stories and the songs of the Irish struggle for freedom, and of Irish patriots like Roddy McCorley, O'Donnell Abu, and Kelly, the boy from Killeen. But amid the songs and stories was the telling of the tragedy and horror and unending sadness brought about by war. Now, obviously, my life and my way of thinking were impacted and even conflicted by such song and story. And that conflict is present in so many of the songs written about veterans. And here are some. The rousingly patriotic Battle Hymn of the Republic, credited to Julia Ward Howe, began as John Brown's Body, with the song's theme being, "He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord, his soul is marching on." By 1862, as the Battle Hymn of the Republic, the song was equating war to the Lord's terrible swift sword. Another war veteran song that morphed into something entirely out of sync with its original form is the song "When Johnny Comes Marching Home," an upbeat declaration of a soldier's joyous and triumphant return from faraway battle. But in truth, that Americanized version began as a sad Irish tune, "Johnny, I Hardly Knew You." While the form most Americans learned implies that each American Johnny, or G.I. Joe, comes home on a sunny midday on the 4th of July, the original song tells a different story, saying of the returning veteran, "You have no arms, you have no legs, you'll have to be put with a bull to beg. Johnny, I hardly knew you." Hardly a message for a recruitment poster. And this St. Patrick's Day weekend, I found a recording of the intense war veteran song about Aussie, Kiwi, and Irish soldiers and sailors who suffered in World War I Battle of Gallipoli, a sad yet beautiful song entitled "The Band Played Waltzing Matilda," sung to perfection by Irish balladeer Liam Clancy of the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem fame. Look it up on YouTube. A young man living the free life of a rover answers the call to service in 1915 and loses his legs in battle, at which point he faces the stark reality that he didn't know that there were worse things than dying. As an old man, he watches his comrades march as the remnants of a forgotten war. And I could go on and on talking of such songs. Rod McEwen's "What Time the Trains Come In" follows a sightless veteran home, lamenting that nobody comes to see a blind man catch a train. In the song "Mama Bake a Pie," Tom T. Hall writes about a country boy coming home as a legless Vietnam veteran, only to read here in the paper that they say this war is just a waste of time. And in 1973, Merle Haggard told the story of Vietnam's POWs and MIAs, left after all dreams had vaporized, to just wonder if they ever think of me. Pretty sad stuff, huh? But then again, maybe it just wouldn't make sense. It would be an incongruity if our war veteran songs turned out happy, because war isn't a happy thing. But a song, a ballad, is a story set to music, and it's important to tell the veterans' stories wherever they lead our hearts to. And I do agree with Francis Scott Key when he said, as he viewed the scene that led him to write the Star-Spangled Banner, these words: "Then, in that hour of deliverance, my heart spoke. Does not such a country and such defenders of their country deserve a song?" Yeah, I'd say so. This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint.
Dan Gallagher is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.